Okay, well, I envy the previous speaker who had nice, clean, geometric patterns to look at. I'm going to be showing you some work today that I've been doing over the last several years. It started with my thesis advisor, Jack Cowan, at the University of Chicago, and has been influenced by my collaborations with Paul Breslauf and Martin Golubitsky. And the patterns that I'm going to talk about today are not nearly so clean as the lattices that we were just looking at from phyllotaxis. I got into working with these gentlemen when we together worked out a solution to a problem that Jack Cowan had formulated 25 years before involving geometric visual hallucinations, which also involved nice, clean geometric patterns. And I won't be talking about that today, but some of the methods behind what I'll show you are similar. What I'll be talking about instead is a pattern formation problem not in patterns of activity, which for those of you who are familiar with the hallucination story correspond to the hallucinations that people sometimes see when their eyes are closed under certain special conditions involving hallucinogens, but rather the structure of the anatomy underlying the cortical circuit that's functioning during normal vision. So first I'll tell you a little bit of biological background and make the suggestion that this might be an appropriate place to study Turing pattern formation mechanisms in a real biological organism, although it doesn't involve morphogens. I'll explain how that works when I get there. And then I will just touch on two things, two problems, one solved and one unsolved. The solved problem has to do with the way that symmetry in the structure of the visual cortex leads to the coordinated pattern formation between different kinds of cortical maps. I'll tell you what cortical maps are in a second. And the second unsolved problem has to do with the dynamics of defect solutions that appear in a sort of noise-driven version of this cortical map formation model. And essentially, the reason I'm including this is because I'm hoping that there's enough experts in the audience on things like defect dynamics and pattern formation out of equilibrium that I might be able to find someone who can help me think through how to finish off some questions involving this last bit. So the area of the brain that's at issue here is the primary visual cortex, which is this little region back here. In your brain, it's about the size of a credit card, tucked in at the posterior end of the occipital lobe. And visual information enters the brain first through the eye, through the retina, then the impulses from the retina are communicated to this sort of relay station called the lateral geniculate nucleus, and then from there to the visual cortex, which at each stage in this processing system, there is a continuous map, I guess is the right word to use in this audience. We call them topographic maps, where neighborhood relations are preserved from points in the visual field or points on the retina, going back to points in the visual cortex. Now, Hubel and Wiesel did pioneering work in the 70s, for which they won the Nobel Prize, showing that points in the visual cortex, so cells, neurons in the visual cortex, are exquisitely tuned for particular features of the visual world. Now, it was known that in the retina or in the thalamus, the lateral geniculate nucleus, that relay station, that you could drive individual neurons to fire at high rates by showing a bright spot of light at a given location in the visual field, and that was called the receptive field of that particular neuron. So the typical experiment would be to show an animal a screen with a little bright spot of light, and you'd move the spot back and forth, and you have an electrode, and at some point it'd go brrp. If you went back, brrp, brrp, you would get a sequence of action potentials, and then you could map out the visual contours where that cell was sensitive. That didn't work in the cortex. They tried very hard to generate strong responses in the visual cortex and couldn't get anything, except occasionally when they were beginning or ending the experiment, they would hear a cell fire off a brisk bunch of action potentials. And what they realized was, the way they were doing the experiment, this is back in the days before laser pointers, or they would never have been able to discover this. They would have a bright light and a sheet of paper with a hole poked in it, and they would be, you know, using the hole poked in the paper to administer a spot of light to different points of the visual field. It was when the edge of the paper passed over a cell's visual field at the beginning of the experiment that they would get a response. Not the dot of light, but the edge of the paper. And it depended which way the paper was being held. So if they always did it, held the page vertically, then some cells would respond, but other cells you had to hold it kind of at an angle. And what they discovered, and this was what they, part of what they got the prize for, was that individual neurons, so here's a slice through layers of cortex, and there's an electrode track going up and down here. So if you record from these neurons, they're recording not only to a particular location, but to a particular orientation of the stimulus. And moreover, all the cells in this vertical penetration respond to essentially the same orientation, give or take maybe 15 degrees. If you move to another point of the cortex, you can find more cells, another column of cells that have the same orientation. But if you move gradually, laterally through the cortex, the orientation shifts. So now you've got a map from the surface of the cortex. Think of the cortex as a two-dimensional surface. In that plane, there's a map not only of the visual world, so a map from R2 to R2, but it's also a map into the circle, representing different orientations. So it's a map from R2 into R2 cross S1, which, of course, is unlikely to be smooth. There are probably going to be points topologically where you have singularities of some sort. But it took 20 more years after these experiments were done before people actually came up with ways of measuring simultaneously the orientation preferences over a whole region of the map. And I'll show you what they discovered in a second. First, let me show you the map of visual location. So this is a piece of basically half the visual cortex, which has been flattened out after the animal was exposed to this little pattern with the black and light and white flashing back and forth. With a, I think there was a radioactive dye that had been used to label which cells were active and which cells were not active. And so this region at the center of gaze, the fovea, mapped to this part of the cortex. The periphery out here maps to this contour here. And so these concentric circles map to more or less parallel bars, and the radial lines map to not exactly parallel, but approximately parallel bars. So out in the peripheral region, this map is, to a fairly good approximation, represented by the complex logarithm, which is a conformal map that preserves angles. And if you are just looking at a small region of cortex, you can, to a pretty good approximation, represent this map as the retinotopic position, so R, positions in the visual field as a function of X, positions in the cortex, as a linear transformation after you've subtracted out some cortical origin, plus a small perturbation. And so this small perturbation, you can see this map is sort of jiggly everywhere. That small perturbation is a vector field on the cortical surface. That's half the visual field. On the other half of the brain, there would be another piece of the cortex, which is representing everything in the other visual field. Both eyes project partly to both visual fields, and they overlap somewhat. This experiment was done through a single eye. And these ripples that you can see on a scale of about a millimeter, this is a centimeter, so on about a millimeter scale, there's a periodicity, which is due to the fact that the individual cells are also sensitive to inputs from one eye or another eye. Most of them are monocular. And so there's a map of ocular dominance, which eye is sending input where, which is another pattern formation problem, which I won't be talking about basically because I couldn't figure out how to solve that and the orientation problem at the same time, which I think there are good reasons for, but I won't have time to talk about that today. So what I'll be showing you, we're ignoring the other eye and sort of collapsing things to pretend there's only the one eye. Okay, this is the map of orientation preference over a 4 millimeter by 2 or 3 millimeter section of cortex So a small region compared to the last map I was showing, which is obtained by optical imaging of intrinsic optical signals. So the way this experiment is done, you show alternatively, you have a sort of a TV screen and you're showing the animal one bunch of obliques and another bunch of obliques. These are gratings that are jittering back and forth, so very strong oriented stimuli. And you do that one, and you do verticals and horizontals. And when a cell is active, or a region of local population is active, there are small changes in how much energy it's consuming, how much hemoglobin is bound, things that change color very slightly. And the absorbance signal is enough that you can actually take the video, take the differences here, you get the preference for this one over this one, the preference for horizontal over vertical, and together this makes a vector field as a function of cortical position. You get, now there's a lot of assumptions behind representing things this way, but this is how people do them. You get a vector field on the cortex that you can represent as the relative preference for horizontal over vertical, and the relative preference for right versus left 45 degree oblique. And because the orientation is something that's only defined up to 180 degrees, you have a double angle representation here. All right, so if you rotate the whole plane by 180 degrees, you get back the same orientation. So when you construct this sort of representation, you're assuming that the response of any cell is describable by the cosine of the difference between whatever angle it likes and whatever angle is presented. And that, so that's not entirely true. There are better ways to represent it. So you could measure, people have gone and measured, you know, 8 pairs of angles at finer gradations and then fit those to cosines. And you can also ask about the, yeah. No, not sharp. It doesn't make a, it's to a first approximation, it's a continuous thing like a cosine. There's a little bit of sharpening, and there's also a little bit of over-representation in the visual field of horizontals and verticals, because those tend to crop up a lot in natural scenes. So the area of the horizontal regions and the vertical regions would be a little bit over-represented. But those are all kind of second-order corrections. Okay, so this is an interesting pattern. I mean, when I first saw this pattern, I decided this is what I had to do my thesis on. Probably not a good decision, because it's a hard problem. But it's got short-range order. There's little patches of things that are similar. Long-range disorder. And there's a combination of these sort of regions where things are changing gradually, like a plane wave and angle. And then, sure enough, there's these singularities, points where all the orientations collapse together to a point. And so how can we look at this as a pattern formation model? Well, the hypothesis that I like to start with is that these patterns of activity reflect something about the geometry of the connections from the thalamus to the cortex. So if this is the layer of nerve tissue in that relay region, the lateral geniculate nucleus, and let's just say we've got retinotopic coordinates here, so coordinates corresponding to visual position. And then we've got the cortex with cortical coordinates, x, r, and x. Then this function represents the weights from every point r in the cortex, in the LGN, to a point x in the cortex. And if you think of it that way, then it's natural to take the retinotopic position to be just the average, and I left out the r. There should be an r there. This is just the total weight. So that should be integral of r dr. Sorry about that. Which is approximately linear plus a correction. And then if you take the second moment of the weights about their centers of mass, so that's this thing. You take the center of mass and then look at the matrix of the covariant, the variances. Then from that matrix Q, you can define this vector, which basically tells you what direction is this little ellipsoidal Gaussian stretched out in, and how far is it from being circularly symmetric. So that tells you the strength of the tuning and the direction of the tuning. And it's a fairly uncontroversial thing within the theoretical neuroscience world to write down a set of equations describing the evolution, the time evolution of the synaptic weights, which is usually some kind of decay plus an operator that represents correlation-based learning, so that cells that are firing together are going to wire together. And because the quantities of interest are linear functionals of the weights, just the first and second moments, you can take the first and second moments of this equation and get the linear part of a system of equations for the dynamics of V. There's also nonlinear terms that play an important role that I won't have a chance to talk about today, but the linear part looks like this weight decay plus a lateral interaction, which comes from lateral interactions in the cortex, J. So that's this function here. And this represents the fact that nearby cortical cells tend to have cooperative interactions, sort of on average, and ones that are spaced further away tend to have inhibitory or competitive interactions. And it's this mixture of center-surround connectivity or local cooperativity and lateral competition that gives you this difference of Gaussians or Laplacian squared kind of term that makes pattern formation possible. So this is acting at the level of these weights, but it's inherited by this in this linearized context by the vector fields themselves. And then there's another term that comes out when you derive, go from here to here, that couples together different vector fields. This is just a scalar function convolved with the individual components. This is a matrix of convolution kernels that are coupling together different components. And this whole thing has symmetry properties, namely it's equivariant with respect to rotations in the plane. So rotation acts in a particular way, I'll show you in a second, on these two vectors, and acts on the elements of this equation, and preserves the symmetry, which has important consequences for the kinds of patterns that form. Okay, so here's rotation by psi. You rotate the cortical coordinates by the angle psi. You rotate the vector field for the visuotopic representation by psi. But when you rotate the orientation preference by psi, you're rotating this chi vector by 2 psi. And so there's this combination, this sort of funny combined action of rotation on the orientation and spatial coordinates that has implications for the pattern formation. And there's also a reflection that acts the same way on everything. I don't want to say much about this. This is just a picture of some of the things that go into K. And in the right combination, they end up giving an equivariant action also. Okay, so to wrap up this part, if we go through a symmetry breaking analysis and look at the assume that we have solutions on a lattice so that we can do the symmetry breaking analysis properly, then we wind up with certain kinds of planforms selected by the usual equivariant branching arguments, and which I'd be happy to go through in detail at lunch, but I wanted to leave out today. And so this is just some of the patterns that we get. If you start with a isotropic homogeneous state, which is corresponds to V equals zero, so no orientation tuning and no distortions of the retinotopic map. And so then all the receptive fields look like so. All the receptive fields are round and they're aligned on a nice grid. And then as you see the pattern start to form, you get these kinds of things. So the little angles, if you can see them, indicate the orientation, and there's kind of a grid there that's stretched in different ways. That is the distortion of the retinopathic field. Okay. So I want to stop with this now, so I have 5 minutes to talk about the other problem, the unsolved problem. And the good thing about what comes out of this analysis is that the symmetry induces correlations between the orientation and spatial maps, which have actually been observed experimentally. And there are other ways of trying to predict what those correlations should be that don't take into account the detailed symmetry arguments properly. And the other ways of doing it yield the opposite prediction of what was actually observed. But if you these patterns that are formed through the symmetry analysis actually make the right predictions about the correlations between the spatial map and the orientation map. But what's bad about this analysis is that these patterns, although they've got the right kinds of singularities, right, these are all pi-fold singularities, they don't actually look a lot like the real maps. The real maps have a lot more disorder, and it would be nice to understand how to get closer to the real thing. So one approach that I've tried is to notice that just looking for at the orientation part of the map for the rest of the talk, there's a potential that you can derive that describes the interactions of nearby points that are essentially trying to align with each other if they're nearby and anti-align if they're further away because of this center-surround interaction. Okay, so two points that are close together you can think of as, just look at the orientation and think of them as little spins, like as if we were looking at a lattice of magnetic spins. Now, Heisenberg introduced this, what's called the XY model for pattern formation in a, or for magnetization in a lattice of magnets where all the magnets are confined to the plane and each one is interacting with its nearest neighbors. You can define an energy function, and now the amount of disorder in that lattice is determined by a temperature variable. So at high temperature, all the spins are going every which way, and at low temperature, they are all trying to align with one another. But because you can make continuous deformations in the spins, you get these pinwheel defects in the Heisenberg model. So what we've done is taken something like the Heisenberg model, but instead of the usual nearest neighbor interaction, we've got this extended nearest neighbor interaction, which represents the cortical interactions. And if you look at, for a finite temperature, the nearest neighbor interactions, you get patterns kind of like this. This is the nearest neighbor interactions with a model where instead of having a spin that's continuous, you've just got plus one or minus one. This is the famous Ising model, or Ising model, depending where you're from. And it makes patterns like this. If you add the extended interaction, the Ising model now has a wavelength in it, which isn't there in the original, and it starts to make much more stripy patterns. And similarly, you get sort of more regular patterns in the XY model with the extended interaction. So this is the first point where I could really use some help. If there's a theoretical physicist in the audience who wants to do something new and different with the Ising and Heisenberg XY models, come talk to me, because the difference that you get by adding a length scale here, I think is pretty interesting. So here's what the model does at different temperatures. So at high temperature, it's completely mixed up. And as you gradually decrease the temperature, you can form a stripe pattern, or you can form sort of a less and less noisy, fairly stripy pattern. I'll show you some dynamics in a second. Yeah, I'm still using a color code from angle from 0 to pi. Right. And so I believe that there's a phase transition in here, and this is another thing I wouldn't mind talking to a theoretical physicist or somebody who can help me understand the pattern formation in this system a little more better analytically. if you just look at the amount of local coherence in the field as a function of the temperature, as a function of the amount of disorder, it grows as you decrease the temperature, the amount of coherence grows. But there's a, in this region it's essentially flat, and in this region it's essentially flat. And you can work out analytically, you know, if it's almost in a perfect pattern with small deviations, or if it's completely random. In both those cases, you can work out asymptotically what this straight line should be like. In this region where the pattern is just starting to form, where there's just enough pattern to sort of make the pattern persist, you have this this spike in the dependence here, and this is indicative of a second-order phase transition, where the thing is essentially freezing into a pattern of pinwheels. And I would very much like to understand that better. Okay, let me finish by, I see that it's 12 o'clock. I could finish here, or I could show a couple of short movies of the dynamics. Movies, okay. So I started a couple minutes late, so I'll go ahead and do that. So in the, if you set the temperature to very low, or set it to zero temperature so that you get rid of the noise, and you're just doing gradient descent, then that Hamiltonian is, if you're just letting the angles move, is the same. This is the same center-surround interaction. It just gives you this dynamics, very simple dynamics. And so you can start with a background field with a defect, and or here's a little local reversal, and the defects attract one another and annihilate. Okay? I would like very much to be able to write down the right equation describing the motion of those defects, something I haven't been able to figure out how to do yet. So I'm putting out bait, if you haven't noticed it. Lunch is coming next, and if you want to come talk to me about this sort of thing, I'm looking for a collaborator. Okay, so here I started with random initial conditions, and it forms a map that looks kind of like the actual maps that that you see with these various positive and negative defects, but now they're going to attract each other, and oops, they all disappear. So in some species, you see very stripe-like patterns, and in other species, you see more spotty patterns with more defects, which probably relates to having a different form for the nonlinearity in different species. Yes, this is with periodic boundary conditions. Yes. It could force you to have one, or yeah, yeah. If you kept on, you could add more and more of a given sign. That's right. Right, right. And the last one, starting with noisy initial conditions doesn't always mean you end up in this ground state. This is a case where you have a stable pattern of defects, this little square lattice, and it, as far as I can tell, it stays there forever. I cheated because I calculated this and then added noise to it, so it knew where to go. But a Scots plaid or a or your family's plaid? Okay, so that's the end, and I'd be happy to take questions. Mary. So what I've showed you doesn't describe activities explicitly, and so not in this setting. But in general, there's some evidence that the center of the pinwheels is coordinated with these regions of heightened cytochrome oxidase localization, which is an enzyme that you can stain for. An enzyme that's involved in getting energy, producing energy for the cells, and supposedly where it's higher, there's more energy being consumed. So that would make you think that you might have more activity at the center of the pinwheels. Near the, in the real data, the pinwheels are not sharp little points because there's a finite amount of noise. They're sort of salt and peppery regions where there's almost the same distribution of everything, as opposed to a salt and peppery region that's dominated by a particular one of the orientations. And so if they're getting essentially input from all the different orientations, that might be a reason why they're, you know, active all the time, since there's always some orientation there and the others are more selective. It's probably nothing that simple, but and people have also tried to measure whether or not the cells are more sharply tuned or more broadly tuned in the pinwheels versus the other regions. And it may well be that the different information that the cells have access to mean that the cells within the pinwheel centers are working together to do one kind of computation for the visual system, and the cells that are outside of them are working together to do a different computation. And, well, this makes an interesting place to work, but there's not really answers at this point. I don't have anything that addresses that. No, I'm sure that Jack Cowan could tell you exactly what these cells are doing this week. It might be different next week, but I don't really know. Yeah. More questions? This dynamics was describing not the pinwheels explicitly, but a pinwheel is a region where this phi term goes around the clock in a small area. So this is the dynamics for the development of the orientations, and the way you can think of that is there's a local field that each cell feels, because it knows it's connected laterally to its neighbors, and it can tell whether or not, as well as to the input it's getting from below, and it can tell whether it's firing at the same time that its immediate neighbors is, or at different times from its slightly more removed neighbors, and it can attempt to adjust the weights coming into it by selectively letting some fibers have more weight and others have less weight, until it is doing more or less the same thing as its neighbors, and as different as possible from its next neighborhood. And so that amounts to changing it, the orientation that it prefers, and that's how you get a dynamics for phi. That's the gradient flow. That's right. Of this, and which is this. Right. So this may be an appropriate approximation for a more complicated developmental dynamics that I've attempted to derive this from. Right. It averages to zero. There's even numbers, and there's tends to be coordination that is similar to this, the one that the movie ended with, which was alternating. Nearest neighbors were opposite signs. Yeah. Thanks for your attention.